Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Welcome to Vernal Equinox 2020. You are probably aware that KMUN, like most of the human pandemic world, has altered to minimum staffing, in this case to keep Free Radio North Pacific operating, and has postponed the latter half of the annual spring pledge drive for a later date, perhaps around KMUN's 37th birthday on April 17th. All pledges in the interim, however, are heartily and gratefully accepted. During this anxious period of global plague and massive shut-in quarantine, in which our homes are isolation wards, electronic media is a major necessity and comfort, quite unlike earlier epidemics when people were bereft of communication and virtually everything else that accommodates civilization. Great credit goes to those who preserve the skeletal fabric of functional community during this deathly crisis, at certain risk to their own health and well-being. I record this program from home on a relatively ancient telephone rather than in front of a microphone, so I am especially indebted and impressed by professional and volunteer media folk who continue to provide communication and information, and also the warmth of comity and candor on the air. Our isolation is not as isolated as a result. I would like to read something that I have written, Silent Spring. To commemorate this first day of spring 2020, the sudden advent of coronavirus seems to be one of those rare, crucial crises, as if everything before now has been inexorably directed toward it, and afterward will be consistently measured from it. Not unlike the mid-20th century, when humanity cracked the atom and realized this unleashed cosmic power foretold our doom. This time, we are not engaged in a world war, but instead in a war of worlds, humans against microbes. To perhaps encapsulate our common mortality, we should think about the oscillation of time whirling planet Earth on a perpetual swing around a star. Each day is not only a moving finger scribbling our passage through time, but also a foot stamping the ground. Time seems to our short, busy lives a linear presence in a round universe, much as the near horizon appears flat on a large globe. Time cannot be held even as long as a breath. Our eroding hearts keep time for us, ticking each hemosecond that perfuses into yesterday. Prognosticating can be a grisly yet irresistible game, especially amidst a worldwide plague estimated even now at its onset to kill millions of humans all over the world before its eventual dormancy. Nothing is more obsolete than yesterday's visions of tomorrow, or as pioneer atomic scientist Niels Bohr remarked facetiously, prediction is difficult, especially about the future. Yet scenarios for the future abound in extensive forecasts of perpetuity, perpetual peace, perpetual progress, perhaps inevitably perpetual life. Starry-eyed projections for this new century millennium have already withered away only after two decades, such as blissful biotechnology returning humanity to Eden, recreating the McDisney mega-corporate fabrication of paradise on Earth, soured almost immediately with 9/11 and the colossal bank failures from which full recovery is a chimera. Clear-eyed 2020 was suddenly impeached by the coronavirus pandemic, which has an ancestry back to around 8,000 BCE, when humanity was itself emerging from the last ice age. But even before the crowning of corona, darker, more grim prophecies gloomed the happy-faced future that initially greeted this new third millennium of the recently anointed current era. Worst-case scenarios envision catastrophic possibilities of utter oblivion of planet and life, which might coincide with the newly foreseen sixth extinction as a result of human transformation of Mother Gaia, our prolific debauchery of Earth since at least the advent of civilization, previously known as the Holocene era, has now been overtaken by the newly coined Anthropocene. After the passing of the current pandemic, if it doesn't congeal into something much worse for human life or immediately presage human extinction by its own vile persistence, we might poison ourselves into absolute contamination by saturating the planet with highly toxic substances, such as with the annually spring pesticide cycle. Soon enough, none of us will be able to eat, drink, or breathe without ingesting lethal and metabolic-altering pollutants we have poured into the land, sky, oceans, and rivers. We now have more adverse chemicals in our bodies that were not present a century ago, most of them artificially produced. We have detrimentally altered virtually everything organic inside and outside ourselves. First and most currently terrifying is that we might very soon lose our oldest and most desperate struggle against microscopic bacteria and viruses. At some vulnerable moment, a bacterium or virus of such intensity and opportunity will soon surge through humanity before it is able to adequately defend itself. A worldwide pandemic such as the current coronavirus might depopulate entire continents of human life. At the very least, tens of millions could die within days or weeks. In the realm of genocide, we might deliberately or accidentally eradicate other human enemies with lethal viruses or chemicals we created to wipe out entire populations of ourselves. Some of these pathogens might be designed to infect everyone but an inoculated few, which could well backfire and infect all and sundry. Other disease-causing agents have been produced for which there is no antidote or antivenom, whatever their original intent, such as pesticides or rodenticides, modified for human targeting. And as we now begin another spring of intense pesticide use, we are exposed to the entire pharmacy of poisons to kill insects, rodents, and other pests. But we are also assaulted by pesticides and virulent chemicals from the air, land, and water, in fields, forests, gardens, and schoolyards. We eat and drink them also in fruits, vegetables, meat, and milk. 1 billion pounds of these poisons are applied annually within the USA alone, and it is virtually impossible to live anywhere in the country without being exposed in some manner or other. Pesticides and biocides are linked to cancer, genetic mutations, nervous system damage, degeneration changes in livers and kidneys. Pesticides show up in mother's milk, are routinely found in blood and urine samples from both urban and rural residents nationwide, and cause irreversible changes that alter genetic material in cells permanently. Rachel Carson, who sounded the alarm about the damage of pesticides in her 1961 book, Silent Spring, called these poisons biocides. Perhaps suicidal ecoterrorism by fanatically impelled divine inspiration, quote-unquote, might resolve to eliminate humanity. Or well-intentioned extremists who believe the human population needs serious thinnings before it irreparably makes Earth uninhabitable, or simply because a smaller quantity of humanity would produce genetic quality, be more eco-friendly, less hostile or neurotic, although that opinion does not seem to appear realistic at any previous era of history, except in small groupings among a mass of generally hostile others during various periods, and none have had any significant or lasting impact. Or yet again, the irresponsible rapaciousness that underlies human civilization and fuels the omnipotence of tyrants and despots might very well be the ultimate horror that destroys humanity and quite possibly the planet. And, of course, we might reactivate the old hobgoblin of nuclear holocaust and blast ourselves out of the universe, as we nearly did over a half-century period, developing arsenals so immense that three decades after the Cold War and its terrifying nuclear arms race, more than enough nuclear weapons remained stockpiled to blow the planet to smithereens several times over. The treaties that forestalled nuclear holocaust a generation ago are being negated, and newer, more lethal nukes are being designed and constructed, even for use in outer space. The ancient axiom, which applies to all of the previously mentioned possibilities of speciesside, is that what humans invent, they use, now or eventually, should be a sobering anxiety. Or then again, we just might allow ourselves to bake like pies in the sun because our industry has torn large, ragged holes in the thin upper atmosphere. We have made beloved Sol, the giver of life, and our first and everlastingly only true God, our immortally mortal enemy. Shame on us. And now, something written by an old friend some time ago. His name is Robert Wilson, and he wrote Our Delicate Planet, A Short History, 23 years ago for the North Coast Times Eagle. You might be familiar with Robert and his work, especially his two charts, Fishes of the Pacific Coast and Sea Creatures of the Pacific Coast. He spent many years as a deep water fisherman, and also worked very hard for a marine science degree from Evergreen University in Washington State. He has been a longtime Astoria resident. Our Delicate Planet by Robert Wilson. As far as we currently know, the Earth, along with the rest of the solar system, was formed between 4 and 6 billion years ago when a cloud of interstellar gases condensed into a number of discrete masses. The most massive of these became the Sun, the only one large enough to ignite fusion and become a star, the primary source of energy in the solar system. Other smaller masses became the planets. The newborn Earth was entirely molten. Over a long time, tens or hundreds of millions of years, the heavier elements fell toward the center and the lighter ones rose toward the surface. The lightest, mainly hydrogen and helium, escaped into space. Eventually, the heaviest elements solidified, forming what we now think of as home. Hydrogen and oxygen combined to form water vapor. When the surface of the planet cooled below 100 degrees centigrade, 373 Kelvin, liquid water could form and collect in low-lying areas. It may have taken billions of years to fill the vast ocean basins. Meanwhile, the Earth was not quiet. Convection currents in the still molten interior brought hot material to the surface, resulting in volcanic eruptions. These eruptions created new land and released new elements into the atmosphere and in the oceans, a process that continues to this day. These elements were concentrated in shallow pools where they were acted upon by solar and other forms of energy. This process formed more complex molecules. At some unknown point, a substance evolved which was capable of making copies of itself, replication. Life was born. It is now believed by some scientists that life may have first evolved around deep ocean volcanic vents in the absence of sunlight. Sunlight may have been involved directly. The next major development was that some of these life forms learned to use energy of sunlight to produce food, photosynthesis. As a byproduct, oxygen was released. Other life forms could then use energy from oxidation to move themselves around. At around 475 million years ago, some cells developed nuclei, concentrating the genetic program into one location. This greatly accelerated the exchange of genetic materials and the characteristics that it represented, creating an explosion of new species, all competing for resources. Evolution has never looked back. At the same time, competing organisms were also evolving into large, interdependent systems. Without the great diversity and abundance of life forms and their complex interconnecting, we would not be here to wonder at it all, a fact too often overlooked or ignored. Plants and animals of the ocean, like those on land, depend on each other for survival. Matter and energy are exchanged. Plants produce food from inorganic compounds using energy from the sun. Photosynthesis again. The amount of energy and nutrients determines the rate of this interaction, limiting factors. The three main limiting factors for the growth of phytoplankton, primary producers, are sunlight, energy, nutrients, and trace elements in the water column. Important trace elements include nitrates and phosphates. As plants and animals die, they sink to the bottom and are broken down by the decomposers, bacteria, releasing nutrients into the water. The nutrients are acted upon by upwelling currents and brought to the surface. The process is slow but continuous. Often the natural cycle of the food web becomes disrupted. This disruption is commonly due to humanity's manipulation and neglect of the Earth's natural resources. Pollution, waste, and just plain lack of concern have taken their toll on Mother Earth. Millions of tons of industrial toxic waste are being dumped into the ocean and their tributaries daily. These toxins kill off many species that are important to the food chain. Once a part of the system is eliminated, an imbalance occurs. The imbalance puts pressure on the other species of the system. Waste disposal along coastal areas is a common practice, especially near cities. Some of this waste is broken down into particulate matter and distributed throughout the ocean. Circulations from coastal and estuarial currents don't always distribute the water effectively. Much of this particulate matter, both organic and inorganic, are taken in by organisms. Waste disposal along coastal areas often interferes with local shellfish and other fisheries. This is due to an insufficient supply of dissolved oxygen from the lack of plant growth, phytoplankton, the primary producers. Those organisms that are not killed by toxins become weak and less able to eliminate some of the problems. Ingestion of toxins causes a buildup in the organism's system, creating an inability to function properly. Due to the abundance of some toxin trace elements, organisms must substitute needed chemistry for what is available. This often causes the organism to become dysfunctional and unable to respond to its own natural behavioral patterns. These coastal discharges also suffocate many of the benthic organisms indigenous to the area. The destruction of habitats has caused the elimination of vitally important species in estuaries and other watercourses. Improper logging practices, agriculture, and urban development systems cause erosion of valuable topsoil. The topsoil washes into streams and estuaries, suffocating many spawning grounds used by salmon and other species. Waste discharges from industries, agriculture, pesticides, power plants, dams, and human cities affect many species. Overfishing and wasteful mining practices threaten entire ecosystems. Better management is necessary. Through a fuller understanding of the delicate environment, we might be able to save it before it's too late. Millions of tons of commercial catch is dumped back into the ocean annually, where it dies and decays. Some of the waste goes back into the system, but much of it is wasted. The Earth has done well on its own, checking and balancing, long before humanity's existence. It doesn't need the unnecessary assistance to the natural cycle. Conservation begins with the individual. Recycling waste daily makes a difference when we all share the same practice. Buying and using biodegradable products will encourage industries to develop more of them. The important thing is to remember one person can make a difference. Begin to appreciate nature as it is because you are a very important part of it. Earth Day is one day of the year set aside to create an awareness of how important conservation is. If every day becomes an Earth Day, then maybe our coexistence with nature can continue and prosper. This generation needs to make a difference. What the last generation has handed down to us may be their fault, but it is our problem. It would be very upsetting to know what the next generation will be totally discouraged with what we have left them, if we leave them anything at all. Make them proud of a clean planet and a well-educated one. Teach how to become better caretakers of this planet. As Chief Seattle once said, the land does not belong to us. We belong to the land. Often we find ourselves taking things for granted instead of taking an active role in our surroundings. We neglect the environment and our vital part in it. The endangered species list is growing daily, yet little is being done to find solutions or take preventive measures. We focus our energies and concerns around our own needs. Nature calls out to us and we just don't listen. It seems to be easier each day to blame another individual or group for what is going wrong. We look outward instead of within for answers. It is too easy to point the finger at others and an easier task to talk about things rather than fix them. An active role is much more rewarding for all of us. Environmentally conscious individuals can make a major difference. Taking an active part is not only the key, but a responsibility for all of us. Awareness is the key to our understanding and the survival of life around us. In early days, humanity reaped the bountiful resources of the earth by hand. With the coming of the Industrial Revolution, we developed the ability, mainly through the use of fossil fuels, to extend our reach and impact on the environment immensely. This has often resulted in injury to the environment. It has changed the way human beings think and respond to their surroundings. Throughout the centuries, there have been different types of revolutions. The environment revolution, during our era, would be a most effective means of saving the planet. Take an active part by educating yourself and others about our surroundings. Educating is one of our roles in the cycle. Information should be shared so that others may learn more about our environment and help create an awareness of our surroundings through a better perspective of it. Therefore, constantly question yourself. What role do we play in such a complex system? It is the curious mind that makes the difference. And that was Our Delicate Planet, A Short Earth History by Robert Wilson. And Wilson said, the interest in outer space precludes interest in the oceans. We have raped, polluted, and exploited the oceans. Instead, we should research and understand the oceans. Without them, we will not be here. Now, Robert Wilson and I were both in the Marine Corps, and both of us were in Vietnam, and both of us served with the 7th Marines. He came about halfway through my tour, and I left about halfway through his tour, and neither of us knew each other. But we were both stationed at Chu Lai, from which the village of My Lai was destroyed on March 16th, 1968. And I would like to read about My Lai and a poem I wrote about it. But first, an explanation. I sum up the Vietnam War in a poem I wrote, an explanation of which takes up considerably more paper than my deconstructed haiku. But it helps understand the poem if a little history is remembered and understood, such as that Song Mai was a large village complex in South Vietnam on the coastal plain south of the Song Trabang River and near the South China Sea. One of its hamlets was My Lai IV, a name which will bear calumny for the rest of American history. It was where a platoon from the U.S. Army's AmeriCal Division under the command of a lieutenant named Rusty Kali, massacred in cold blood at least 200, but probably more, Vietnamese women and children, plus a few old men found in the village on March 16, 1968. This slaughter of unarmed civilians was ostensibly in revenge for the costly Tet Offensive launched by Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army regiments the previous month, but it also reflected Standard Operational Procedure, SOP. Though the dead at My Lai were gruesomely more numerous than other search and destroy operations, they were murdered in the same manner Vietnamese were killed all over South Vietnam by Americans, whether by infantry invasions of small villages or by the strategic slaughter by artillery and air attack. My Lai might have gone unnoticed except for a soldier who joined the AmeriCal Division at Chu Lai, which was a USMC base most of my time in Vietnam, after My Lai, and listened to the stories the soldiers who had been there told. His name was Ron Ridenour. He is dead now, and few know him by name, but he did at least two great services for the USA about Vietnam. He made the American public aware of My Lai after Congress refused to pay attention to his revelations about the massacre. And later, as a civilian reporter back in Vietnam, he broke the news about the use of the chemical defoliant Agent Orange, yet another government secret that was a tragic example of his callous short-sightedness, knowingly poisoning its own soldiers to get at an enemy. Because of Ridenour and the more known Seymour Hersh, who wrote the first My Lai story, the name My Lai is emblematic of the entire war, the more than a decade the USA spent waging an unnecessary and savage war that embodied blatant racism and virtual disregard for centuries agreed upon laws of warfare. But also the massacre at My Lai represents the random waste of lives in small brush fire conflicts conducted through clients by two superpowers in an aggressive and possibly obliterative contest for world supremacy for half a century, in each of the small wars, releasing pressure that might otherwise explode into mutual nuclear annihilation, yet simultaneously cocking the trigger for just such an explosion. This is why I believe my petite haiku sums up the entire Vietnam War experience. Song Mai, my song. My Lai, my Lai. And that's the poem. In April 1971, Rusty Calley was found guilty and confined to house arrest for about a year. He said to the court-martial board of his slap on the wrist, "You stripped me of all honor. Please, by your actions that you take here, don't strip future soldiers of their honor." But the My Lai prosecutor, Army Captain Aubrey M. Daniel III, countered Calley, saying what he did stripped him of his honor. It can never be honor to kill unarmed men, women, and children. And former Captain Dr. Howard Levy, a Green Beret doctor who refused Vietnam duty for conscientious reasons, said, "I was punished for refusing to obey an order. Calley was convicted for failing to disobey one." But let's face it, both of us are scapegoats. And in closing, Robert Wilson started the Astoria chapter of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And that's how I met him, because I was sort of the Oregon regional coordinator of it. And Robert and I have been friends since. This is Michael McCusker. Happy birthday today to Suri Mirsapasi.